Good morning, afternoon, or evening, wherever or whenever you are. This is the Lightning Podcast, where we discuss and explore the weekly meditations without necessarily reaching any conclusions. I'm your host, Cyrus Polysbon, and I'm joined today by Ann Dudek and Zohar Atkins. Welcome, everybody.
Welcome, welcome.
Today's quote that we're going to cover is by François de la Rochefoucauld. From Maxims, and it goes, "A man who likes nobody is much more unhappy than a man whom nobody likes."
Zohar, what's your take on this? Because it's fairly easy to understand what the author is saying here, but what's your take?
So who is this de la Rochefoucauld guy? I believe he was a 17th century nobleman, French nobleman. If you're a person of nobility, you're like a socialite with higher table stakes because people that you know can die if the political tables turn. His great grandfather was killed in political intrigue related stuff. And so I'm sure this stuff about liking people and not being liked isn't just how you feel, but is also about alliances where the personal and the political overlap in some way. And I'm reading it a little bit through that lens. A man who likes nobody is much more unhappy than a man who nobody likes. You would think that if you're liked by nobody, that's a bad thing because you're a pariah. But at the same time, if you like nobody, then maybe you don't have any alliances. So we can get into the psychological ramifications of this line. And I'm sure there's some wisdom here as well about like how it's good to love and have your heart broken rather than be an island or something like this. But reading it through the lens of political intrigue, I think it's saying you need allies. And if a man who likes, it is a tongue twister, a mind twister, a man who likes nobody is much more unhappy than a man whom nobody likes.
I almost read it as he's going against his own grain here, his own world state. And saying that, you know, if nobody likes you, that's a problem in court because then you have no allies. You know, you could not like someone, but don't tell anyone about it. You know, you could not like somebody and lie about it and keep false pretenses. But he's saying, no, like, it's not worth it. Like, it's not worth you disliking people. Like, it's more important for you to like people, to like just love people in general, not be a misanthrope, than for you to have the favor of the court but be like torn up inside. Like, better the life in here than your actual life.
I hear you. So in the history of philosophy, there was a critical turn with Machiavelli, who was a philosopher who believed that the purpose of philosophy was the practical administration of leadership as opposed to just understanding theory. And he turned a lot of things on their head. He turned Christian morality on its head because he said that if you practice turn the other cheek and these kind of Christian virtues as a political leader, you're going to get yourself killed. So there's this whole art to politics that actually involves doing the opposite of what morality is for the everyday person, hence the adjective Machiavellian today. But I think Machiavelli would say, in fact, he did say, it's better to be feared than to be loved. Specifically in his advice to leaders, that ultimately, if you're loved, you're seen as weak. But if you're feared, then you're gonna get more out of your subjects. So you could also read this a little bit through that lens, that a person who nobody likes is not so unhappy, because who says that he wants to be liked in the first place? Maybe, especially in the context of a court, like your number one desire is for a certain reverence or a certain respect. And so by definition, you can't try to be likable. Like, likability actually undermines your cause. What do you think, Ed?
Yeah, that's what along the lines of what I was thinking, because whether you look at it through the Machiavellian lens or how we're reading this right now, it's about engagement. And so it's very much you have to be engaged with the broader community, public, court, whatever it is. And that's really what I'm reading here, is that even if you don't like it, go out and engage.
You have to go out and sell your art.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that led me down the path, which is, I forget where this originates from, but it's essentially like what you dislike in other people is usually a source of envy. If you have a coworker and you're like, oh, I hate how they do this, usually it's because you're slightly envious of a facet of one of their actions. Obviously, that's not true everywhere, but, and I think that if you like nobody, it feels very defensive to me, almost like you've built up a lot of walls. And again, there's not this engagement that you're reaching out to. And that usually speaks more to your internal state as opposed to the state of everybody else.
Now, if you're asocial or if you're antisocial or judgmental, it must be because of a lack of resolve in yourself. Whereas if you like yourself, then you'll like other people. Maybe this is,
and I think
there's like a hierarchy, and he's focused on the bottom of the barrel. He's saying, I found something that's even worse than being universally disliked, not as being a universal disliker.
Yeah. The inverse of the statement's true, right? A man who likes everybody is much more happy than a man whom everybody likes. Do you think that's true?
Like the opposite of love isn't hate, it's apathy. So you don't want people to be apathetic towards you, and you don't want to be apathetic towards people. So
I feel like if you like everybody though, that's also shallow, because I guess it all depends on how we interpret this liking people. I think if you read it as if you find an aspect of everybody to like, then it's quite a noble way to be. But if it's you're friends with everybody, which is often how this is interpreted, that you're gregarious and affable, it's like your relationships are probably quite undiscerning and insubstantial if it's so easy to like people. So what do you think about this idea of discernment and judgment that comes in deciding who you want to associate with and who you don't want to? Like, how do you decide when this discernment is a virtue? Because it means that when you do like someone, you really like them. And when it's a vice, because to your point, Anne, it says more about your own hangups than it does about the other person.
That's such a good point. I always have such difficulty with the word like, because to me, it's a very superficial word. And so now that we're talking about it, I honestly don't know how to take it in terms of the discernment, because like to me has always been very like surface level engagement and adjective.
So the word like has that Valley Girl association with it. Like
maybe that's why I can't take it seriously.
It also has the more original aspect, which is analogy, which is one of the fundamental ways that people have been arguing and making and being persuasive for thousands of years. And one of the meta debates that we often have in contemporary discourse is whether an analogy is appropriate or not, which is already absurd, because how can you really argue whether an analogy is or isn't appropriate, when the whole point of the analogy is that you've expressed your discernment that these two things are worthy of a comparison. And when someone says, no, they're not, all they're doing is disagreeing with your judgment. It's not actually a debate. I like to make absurd analogies, but I always worry that they're going to get shut down precisely because of the superficiality of analogy itself. There's something very provocative about comparing something to something that is obviously nothing like it, even though in poetry...
The key is to speak from a position of authority when you make an analogy, to speak from a position of utter confidence. And then that person's, oh, yeah, you're right. Wow. Yeah. And then think about it like that. I'm sure Anne's done that once or twice when describing a
Twice? I do it like 5 times a day. Are you kidding me?
If you're liking people,
walking into a foyer and saying it's like...
If you're liking people, you're analogizing yourself to them and them to you. And if you're liked by people, then you are the object of their analogy. I know that's very narcissistically framed, but perhaps that is just the way that we enter into likeness, right? Likeness as in similarity. Just riffing on the word like now.
Yeah, but I think that isn't that true, because the only frame of reference for reality that we truly have is our own. And so everything is measured against our own self and our perception, because we truly can't understand anything else. I feel like I tiptoed into some very philosophical stuff and butchered it. So maybe you can help bring that to some more clarity.
Man who nobody likes. I'm even though this phrase is so straightforward, it's just hard to fully absorb. He likes is much more unhappy.
Well, you think about that. I actually want to go back to the Machiavelli quote you said, which is actually a meditation we did many months back. Go check it out. It's on Meditations on Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Anyways, no, the quote is, it is better to be feared than loved. That's the quote. But okay. I believe the quote said, if you cannot have both, it is far better to be feared than loved. Mm-hmm. But I think it's because love is in the same boat as like, because like is just a lukewarm version of love, that it is far more likely to prevent your subjects or others doing the things you don't want through fear than it is to inspire them to do the things you do want through love. Or at least in so much as the love that you can inspire in that many people.
I think that's true when you're ruling by military force or you run a police state, but that's obviously not true in a liberal society where you can be voted out of office if you're or feared, or if you're the CEO of a company and you can be subject to an employee revolt or a hostile takeover. Perhaps in a world in which your rivals are also alphas, and so you have to be the most alpha in order to make them not even think about being a contender. But in a more like polite or like consensus driven society, I think we do reward collegiality rather than fear, certainly in the longer run.
Yeah.
So I don't think
we also have such a complex system in place to ensure that happens, to ensure that dominant militaristic alpha doesn't succeed. We have so many layers of social contracts and constitutions, a constitution on top of everything that sets it all up. You strip it all away, then you're left with what Machiavelli
talks. This is not my expertise in terms of like theory of war and game theory and all of that, but it's a common saying that nations are at peace with one another when they calculate the cost of war as being so great that they would never think to enter into it, which often leads to the paradoxical conclusion that a nation that's perceived as belligerent or a leader that's perceived as bellicose is better positioned to maintain peace than one that's seen as quote unquote peaceful or pacifistic, because the pacifist isn't going to retaliate when you attack. And thus, in a sense, they're giving you permission to do so.
Yeah. So this is the world that Francois is coming from.
Yeah. A man who nobody likes, forget about happiness. The point is, there are examples of leaders that are universally disliked, yet in a sense, they're also respected. And some of it, I think, has to do with the fact that they're seen as having a strong sense of their own compass, whether you want to call it a moral compass or not, such that their likability doesn't affect them. Even people you radically disagree with, you can stand in awe of the fact that they're so brazen. And so I think that's why such a person is happy. Of course, or at least not the most unhappy. Of course, we didn't get into the question of why is happiness the goal, or is happiness the goal? There are villains who don't sleep well at night, and there are villains who do sleep well at night. Like, does it matter whether sleep well? Should that be the rubric for their villainy?
Not for their villainy, but for their happiness.
Yeah, I think that maybe a man who nobody likes, he's not judging his worth based on other people's opinions. So he's totally unfazed by the fact that nobody likes him. He knows his position. He's moving forward. He's got it. Man, that nobody is only considering other people. So I feel like it's like polar opposites.
It's just a statement about what's in the external world versus what's in the internal world.
I don't think anybody who's reaching for power has happiness as a goal, though. I don't know if that's too brazen of a statement, but those to me seem misaligned, not super familiar with Machiavelli, but I assume he doesn't speak too much on happiness.
So maybe we need to look at the quote again and another word in the quote again, like we looked at, and look at unhappy instead of thinking of it as joy or maybe we look at happiness as convenience, maybe from his point of view. Oh, it's an unhappy day. I'm beset by troubles and whatnot. Maybe he's saying a man who likes nobody is much more inconvenienced than a man who nobody likes.
Can you visualize a man who likes nobody and a man whom nobody likes? These are quite extreme cases. A man who likes nobody?
I think of movie tropes that's what comes to mind. No, one who likes nobody is probably someone who's been bullied a lot and didn't find a way out or an outlet or a friend or something to escape in. And it's just like against the world and quiet in their corner. And then the man who nobody likes is the big loud bully who's like oblivious to the pain he's caused and is just going around in his ignorance being an asshole, but he's seemingly fine. That's what I picture. Yeah.
No. That was Caligula for a man nobody likes.
Nice.
Interestingly.
Telling is because somebody popped into mind, like specifically immediately for the latter half of the quote, and nobody pops into mind for the beginning half of the quote. What about you, Zohar? Did you have anybody
like
in mind?
Nietzsche? Not even like Nietzsche. Who likes nobody?
Nico and I were talking about Darth Vader on the last episode as enlightenment gone awry. I suggested that Darth Vader represents like perfect contemplation without compassion, which is why he has the Force, which is like awesome. But then it's a red lightsaber suggesting that something is deficient about his enlightenment. I think a person who likes nobody is like Darth Vader, by which I mean there's a certain prowess in not being attached to anyone. Because especially when you take a Buddhist angle on this, and they say that the cause of suffering is desire or attachment, one interpretation, perhaps a newbie interpretation of this, is that you should therefore stop liking anyone and everything and just be disassociated. I think that would be a very unhealthy way to live. Ironic that some might call that enlightenment, or that you could put the brain scan of the Buddhist monk and the brain scan of the person who's clinically debilitated to the point of nothing pleasing them, and maybe they would show the same thing. I don't know that they would. I'm just positing that as a thought experiment. But you often see that these monks have big smiles on their faces. And so it feels like they like everybody, or they like a lot of things. How is it that they're so affable and have so much light and joy, even though presumably they've been practicing all this non-attachment? I'm sure I'm like butchering the concepts and that the great sages have cut through these paradoxes, but it seems like in the phrase likes nobody is both prongs of this dilemma, and that one way to nobody is to be a kind of curmudgeon or a kind of apathetic personality, and the other is to not look to other people to fill your own void or to solve your existential problems and do the work yourself, as they say, do the work. And if you do, then you'll be able to connect to others, even though you don't like others in the superficial sense. So I think that it goes back to the ambiguity of the word like. There's an unhealthy and a healthy way to like people. And so if you like people in an unhealthy way, then perhaps it would be better not to like anybody. But if you like them in a healthy way, then you should continue to do.
You said a lot there. I'm going to go back and connect what you said about the monks to the healthy versus unhealthy way. And then also link it back to Star Wars, because I'm a huge Star Wars nerd. The Jedi are monks, right? Are Buddhist monks, essentially, in the story. And their idea is not to get attached to things. And so it is with monks. I think the reason they're always smiling.
The one paradox in that is that even if they are non-attached, don't they ultimately want light and the good side to win? So I think I'll go along with what you're saying, but I always find that to be a paradox, that if you were truly non-attached, then you shouldn't really care. Darth Vader and the Death Star having sovereignty or not, like, you wouldn't really care for the Empire. Anyways, and Francis
you could,
as well, like Jungian philosophy, that at the highest level, if you see good and evil as interdependent, then how can you really be a champion for the good once you've come to see that evil isn't actually evil?
Okay. So, I mean, at the end of the day, Luke does cast aside his lightsaber instead of striking down his father, which in a practical sense, yeah, he just killed Darth Vader. Like, now you can turn your attention to this old guy with the wrinkly face. But he doesn't make the rational decision and decides, I'm not going to participate in this conflict anymore. But that's beside the point. Let's put a pause on the Jedi. I think that when you're talking about unhealthy versus healthy likes, a Buddhist, a monk, for example, is aiming to detach himself, letting go of attachment to things. And because he's not afraid of losing them, he's able to appreciate them fully for what they are in the moment. And that's where their happiness comes from. And it moves from thing to thing. And they're just in this state of present, as opposed to worry for the future or longing for the past. And I think that is a healthy like of being present, and appreciation is a healthy like appreciation. But the attachment or wanting to own something, ownership or possession, is the unhealthy. If you want to possess everybody, that's incredibly unhealthy. If you just change the words and say, a man who wants to possess everybody is like, oh, stay away from me. But a man who appreciates everything, you're like, ah, yeah, that guy, I love that guy. I want to be like him.
But I think if we go with the unhealthy version, like, there's a fascinating point here psychologically, which is, okay, we all agree that if a person who goes around relating to other people as possessions to own and control is toxic. That being said, such a person would still be, even if they went around with this attitude and nobody reciprocated in turn, no one was like, oh, yes, I enjoy being owned and controlled. So that person would be the person whom nobody likes, meaning they go around liking others in this sort of off-putting way and people are off-put by it. Even that person is advantaged over the person who has no appetite whatsoever. And so the question is why? And I think, perhaps this is an insight that just came to me and it connects to something Anne said, that when you like somebody, even if you like them in an unhealthy way, ultimately they represent some aspect of yourself that's aspirational for you. By liking them, you can attach yourself to some aspect of what they stand for or what they're manifesting for you that you want to see manifest in your own life in some way. And so at least that person has an element of striving and aspiration, even if it's coming out in a very imbalanced and ineffective way. But the person who likes no one has no striving, has no aspiration. So now, just if we wanted to translate this in different terms, a person who strives after nobody, who has no heroes, who has no role models, is much more unhappy than a person who is universally rejected. Better to have 1,000 mentors who tell you that your work is utterly crap than be an artist who thinks that you're better than Picasso and Cezanne and has never taken a painting class because you just think that you're a genius and nobody can help you.
I've met several of those people. But I think like that analogy like brings to point like a question I've been thinking over, because especially when it comes to art, I think people are like, oh, are you happy like when you make art? And you're like, no, that's not like the base emotion, I would say, because happiness is like pure and shining and to me very ephemeral. It's a moment, it's a short period. And I think that for me, there's this idea, the long term would be fulfillment, right? Or fulfillment in your own expression or your own concept. So I've hung up on this word unhappy because to me, it's a shiny, pure yellow of a moment and it has no real long term effect or impact. That's not what happiness is. It's just for now and it's not for later. Is this a very demented view of happiness?
No, I think you're right. I think, and
like one is that a man who likes nobody is much more dopamine deficient than a man whom nobody likes. That would be
That's
and then the other is just the word like a man who likes nobody is much more unfulfilled than a man whom nobody likes.
Yeah.
I want to make a point to that as another artist. I think everybody's has an artist inside them, but as someone who practices a quote unquote art for a living, when you're happy, you want to be happy. So you're dwelling in that place. You don't want to do anything else. You know, you're in that happy state. But when you're not, then that's, I need to do something to get there. And that's what art is. It's that struggle to get back, or that expression to get back, or to somehow resolve with what you're feeling, which is not happiness. It's that you get happy by doing art. You're not happy doing it, but it's an attempt to like get somewhere closer to it. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think it's an attempt to get that dopamine hit that Zohar is talking about. Yeah, I think the reservation on the word happy goes back to that. Now we've called out, I have, two words as being like superficial in this quote, like likes and happy. And so I guess I can't take this quote too seriously. I think it has like a beautiful meaning, but to me, it actually doesn't seem that deep.
Maybe happiness isn't superficial. It's just ephemeral. Is ephemeral the same thing as superficial to you?
No, it's not the same thing. So yeah, I do believe happiness is ephemeral, but not superficial. Yeah, I can get on board with that.
I think maybe the reason those Buddhist monks can have it, or apparently have it so much, is because they're always in that ephemeral state. They let go of all attachments, so they're just in a flow of one thing to another. Now we can't do that because you just can't let things go, and you can't not think about things coming up. So then you quickly lose the happiness, because
I feel that De La Rochefoucauld's style is an ephemeral style. Like, he wrote maxims. He was an influence on Nietzsche, who also wrote aphoristically. There is something like almost just you're sitting on a bench journaling, just observing like the leaf falling, and then taking that sort of scrutiny, the universe in a single moment, and bringing it to social relations. And so it's almost like a disassociated observer state, just beholding French society, writing about it. And so I wonder, is he the person who likes nobody as he's doing this? Is he battling his own demon and saying, listen, writer, don't just sit there doing anthropology. Get in the arena. Go and risk being the person that nobody likes, because a lot of introverts probably also enjoy the position of the observer, because then you get to be the judge, but nobody's judging you. Go and be the person that nobody likes rather than the person who likes nobody. I feel that this is good advice specifically for introverts or people that feel like they're watching others in the arena, but not in the arena themselves.
Yeah.
Good advice for academics and journalists.
No, it's true. But I like this quote as an action item, maybe just not as a thought piece.
What's the call to action? Go like somebody today.
I think actually it's
hit that like about, button.
Yeah, it's not even about that. It's go put yourself in a position for somebody to like you or dislike you. Like you said, Zohar, sometimes we protect ourselves too much, and it doesn't make us open to, and you're right, we get to sit apart, and we get to have this apart kind of a judge. But it's like, no, go out and be part of the crowd.
I remember I did this, so clinical and pastoral education was part of my rabbinic training. And so there's a practical element and a reflective element to the training. The practical is you visit people who are in a position of anguish and you accompany them. And the reflective is then you workshop your experience and how effective or ineffective you were at providing some kind of spiritual care. So I mainly work with the elderly, the sick and dying. And I can't remember the details of this particular client because it was years ago, but I remember telling my supervisor that I didn't like a particular person, or I found it difficult to connect with them. And he asked me, what is one thing about them that you like? And I had a really hard time, but it's a great question to ask yourself, even with characters that are unlikable. I think this could also be a practice of giving generosity of spirit to people, even if it's not saying you have to like them. In my interpretation, you can still dislike them. You can still find them off-putting or that you don't want to connect, but that doesn't mean that you couldn't find one thing to appreciate about them.
So. Yeah, that helps me work with people I don't like, other artists,
the
other
actors. Iris. Anyone on this podcast right now?
No. when you're in a production of a play, for example, and you have a run for however many weeks, and you have to be with have to trust another person so utterly, and they have this ego and whatever happens behind the stage. When you get on the stage, when you're acting, you have to come up with it. You have to feel the things that you're presenting. You have to make them true in your mind, at least for a little while. And so really, if you don't like somebody, you got to find something to like. And it's exactly what Zohar's said, is you find that one thing that you can latch onto, because as soon as you can do that, emotion comes in and then you can act through that emotion.
What about?
Yeah, I think that's very great advice in general. Liking somebody.
Separate from working with people you don't like, what about, do you ever have a role that you're cast into where you don't like the character you're supposed to play?
Especially in school in conservatory, when you don't really have a choice and they ask you, hey, can you do this? Like you need you to fill this role. Like no,
like an actor who likes no role is more unhappy than an actor whose roles don't like him.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah, you can't. If you listen to interviews too of like great film actors who portray great villains, they always have something good to say about their character. They always latch onto something positive.
So true.
Yeah, I'm sure you've watched an interview or something of someone you loved or a film you liked. Oh, I just really want to hear what they had to say about this because I love this so much. And they'll always say something good. You have to find something positive to act from, because unless you as an actor really do hate yourself utterly, then I don't know if you could even perform. I don't even know if you'd want to perform. I don't even know if you'd show up if you really did.
The role of somebody who's self-loathing though.
Yeah, you could maybe likes too specific of a word. Maybe just identify, empathize with, oh, I remember a time when I didn't like anybody. Maybe a man who empathizes with nobody is much more unhappy than a man who nobody empathizes with.
Who's your favorite villain as a character that you've seen in film?
Oh, gosh.
That's a great question.
This is with the bomb, Zohar. I don't know. I'll keep it in my head.
Do you have an answer? This is the edge of my thinking, actually.
I had one that came to me during the conversation, so I got a little bit of a head start. Brainstorming. Ooh. But in the film Inglourious Basterds, the Nazi, I forget his name, but he speaks
Christoph
like...
Christoph Waltz.
The actor Christoph Waltz.
Yeah. That's such a good one.
Incredible job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it helps that it's a comedic villain is maybe easier to like than a dramatic villain.
But I also think it makes him more sinister. Like there are scenes like when he's eating the strudel. I don't think I have ever felt so uncomfortable as even through Saw movies, that strudel eating scene really did a number on me.
I'm going to cheat here, not think for a second about my favorite villain and talk about Zohar's. I believe in an interview, someone was like, how did you play him? How did you feel playing this guy who like hunts people and kills them like they're animals? And he says, I could be wrong. I could be misremembering who said this, but he's like, I just try to look at it from his point of view. He's just doing his job. He's doing a service to his nation or whatever. He sees this as a problem and he's the one who's there to clean it up, so to speak, because that's how these people thought about Jewish people. And so that was, and so you, then you take, as an actor, you'd be like, okay, for the sake of the role, you ignore the fact that these are people, and you focus on the fact that I'm doing a job, I'm cleaning up, I'm doing a service, and you focus on that, and you ignore everything else.
And I feel like that's very meta, though, because that's exactly how we got into this problem in the first place, was that compartmentalization.
Yeah.
Almost as if, I'm going to say something provocative, Cyrus, and no offense intended by it, but what if societies commit the greatest atrocities when their citizens become so sinister or so cynical that they all perceive themselves as actors? Like, when is acting itself a kind of cop-out? Because you're able, as an actor, to just focus on us playing a role as opposed to taking the more sober view of the reality. Everything becomes a little bit more easy when you see yourself as just in a role or just on a stage. Where's the responsibility? And it's a rhetorical question, but I'll give one other anecdote on this point that sticks with me, which is Stanley Cavell, who's a literary scholar, and he wrote about the experience of Othello, of watching Othello, and he goes, why is it that whenever people watch the play and they see Othello strangling his wife, somebody doesn't get up on the stage to stop it from happening? If you really believe that this is happening, then it's murder. You should get up there and do something about it. And obviously you know that it isn't. So then how are you able to get absorbed in the drama knowing that it's just a play? In other words, and then how do we know we aren't doing that in daily life on some level? Saying, oh, don't worry, that's just an actor. I don't have to do anything about it.
Yeah.
There is a book written on that. I think it's called The Nature of Evil, and it's on the Nuremberg trials. And this one Nazi who had a desk job, and he basically orchestrated, I believe it was like the trains to the concentration camp. So he's responsible for millions of people dying. But to him, he was like running efficiencies and doing his bureaucracy and doing his desk job and doing his role as like effectively a middle manager. And I think that that's what the book is about, that it's like, when you accept these roles without a broader view, you can become part of this like really like huge malevolence if you just keep your head down and keep it within your sphere. And it was that like the kind of like evil can be very mundane. It can be like a middle manager. And yet if you just view yourself as that and nothing else, then absolve yourself. It was an intense reading.
Totally true. No, I'm agreeing with you. I'm so hard, but so back to your question. If everyone was actors, the world would be a madhouse. I think, I mean, wrap myself out, but
we are actors in the world.
Yeah,
yeah. Still, I think we're already there.
All the world's a stage. When you, it's just a crazy thing to do. Like, you're literally pretending to be somebody else in front of other people, you know, but there's an actor. At least myself and a lot of actors I know, for example, it's not easy to lie. It's actually difficult to lie because when you're acting, you're trying to believe what you're portraying to be true in the lens of the stage. Like, you basically create a separate rule set almost for life in this space. Okay, things work differently here. It's just like when you watch a movie, you're like, things are working differently. I understand what's going on there. It didn't actually happen, but it does happen. It does matter in some way, but not in all the exact ways that me poking my fellow audience member does. This is another world than that. Like, a lot of the things are similar, but there's things that are different. And so when you get into that space of acting, you enter into a new space, a new set of rules, a new understanding. So it doesn't apply to outside world. Like, you don't make those, is someone at a party, a lot of times people will ask me to do that voice again or do that bit from whatever it is. A lot of times I'm just like here, man. But if I can get into the zone of, oh, I'm perform, then all of a sudden you switch the rule set in your head and you're like, okay, this is my little stage, this little area among these people by the fireplace, boom, and then you go into it. But there is a switch that happens. There is a switch, and it's not, I think people hiding, like, people are always acting, but I think the imaginative aspects of acting are, they have to be set up. There needs to be an environment for them. Now, if you create that environment, let's say what Anna's saying about that desk job guy, it's like you create the environment, you create a new rule set, then that becomes a problem, or not a problem if it's something admirable. So let's say a business with a great culture is like, hey, normally when you say a really dumb idea, people normally make fun of you, but here we're going to reward you for thinking outside the box and just really celebrate that more than you normally would in a normal societal setting. So I think it, a big part of it is the framework that's set up around it. I don't even remember the original question. This is letting me go on for too long. Dan, what's your favorite villain?
No, I want to know about the art world, like where you think there's similarities and differences from the world of actors. Because it is also about creating this dual identity where you're one way in the street and another way at the canvas, so to say. Like, isn't there a vicariousness?
I don't know. That's why I'm really amazed and floored. I've never heard acting described that way, Cyrus, but it makes perfect sense when you do it. And I think, like, for me, it puts acting in like a separate category, because there's like this cognitive dissonance with the real world, quote unquote, that you go through in order to assume that role, be that person. And I'm like, that's so fascinating to me. And I'm just wondering if artists already feel that cognitive dissonance with just most of reality. And so they start creating out of that space. And maybe that's the similarity. But that's a riff off the top of my head. I would have to think about that more, because that's really a fascinating way to view acting now. Which actually brings one of my two favorite villains is Daniel Day-Lewis in There Will Be Blood, because I think like he is so calm, but there's just always this violence that like is under the surface. He's so menacing in that movie. And then the same thing of who is it in No Country for Old Men? Like this
Javier Bardem's character.
I think that the placidness that sort of coats violence is really unnerving to me, and I think that's what those two characters have in common. So
I really love the I'm thinking now, and I think it's Hannibal from Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, same thing.
And I love him because of the one part of him that's not villainous. And there's a scene, have you both seen the movie?
A long time ago.
I don't want to spoil.
Yeah, but not for a long time.
So there's the detective who visits him. I think her name, the actress who plays him, is Jodie Foster. She visits him several times through the movie, and he shows an interest, or at least an affability towards her. For whatever reason, he treats her very respectfully and whatnot. And the last time she visits him, he finally pushes her to talk about this one thing that's like tormenting him. And the camera zooms in close on his face, and he's a psychopath and seems very hungry. He's pushing her. He's pushing this line of inquiry. I believe he was a psychiatrist. That was his job. And he's pushing this line of inquiry on her. And you see this hungry expression, like he's digging. It seems like he's digging to get into her. And she finally lets out why she's hearing these. And it's called The Silence of the Lambs, because when she was a kid, she heard these lambs crying and screaming before they were getting slaughtered or whatever. And he's digging for why she does what she does, I think, to silence them, to keep them. And then she says, yes, yeah. She lets out all her emotions. She's very raw. She's like some very beautiful, but also sad reason for why she does what she does and in the world. And she just wants to ease the pain or whatever. I forget what it was. But then the next shot, again, that extreme close-up of his eyes, they're soft for the only time in the movie. They're the slightest bit of sympathy or empathy even. And then he says, thank you Jane, thank you very much. He says very sincerely, and then it's gone. And in that one moment, you see the smallest shred of humanity in him, the smallest little bit. And I was like, oh, you know. And this is a freaking cannibal, someone who eats other people and plays with them and doesn't care. I thought that was amazingly the humanity shines that much brighter when it's through that much darkness and what have you. But I actually do want to go back to the actor thing, because you reminded me what Zohar had asked. And I think everyone should, it is my opinion, everyone should go to an acting class, because you learn emotional control, not like suppressing your emotions, but you learn how to channel an assignment of meaning, how to assign meaning to things. It's much easier to do that. And I think it's very helpful in day-to-day life. And so you need to work with someone you disagree with on a lot of things. If you, let's say you were a very immature person, like akin to a child, you would dislike that person because they want things that you don't want. But a mature person is able to say, no, well, here's the things we find common ground in. And acting is just an extreme version of that mental exercise of taking one thing and ignoring others. Yeah.
I have two thoughts. One in response to that, and then one on the quote. This idea that everyone should take an acting class because it would improve their self-expression and their communication. I've heard a version of this idea. I hear a version of this idea almost every week from people who say something to the effect of everyone should study nonviolent communication because it would improve X, Y, and Z. And I don't disagree per se, but I feel that there's a big assumption in all of that, which is that the goal is common understanding and deeper relationship. And so I would just qualify with, if the goal is to connect to somebody, then work on your communication. However, I think there's an implicit assumption that you should want that. You should want to connect. Mm. And that's where I think, no, I don't think you should. I think you should just be self-aware and self-honest about what your goal is. And if your goal is not connection, then studying how to be empathic is not going to help you. And you shouldn't be forced to empathize. I think these sort of like pluralistic, like liberal type people, I guess I count, count myself in their community. But I think they assume that you should want to be liberal and pluralistic and civil with everybody in every situation. And I don't agree with that assumption. So as long as we qualify it, then I'm good. On the quote.
So hold on to your second. Hold on to that second bit. Address that. I'm not saying that for communication skill. It's a thing that can help your communication skills, but it's because it helps your self-sovereignty. Nice. When you can, I think the tools of acting helps you become more sovereign over yourself, self-control, self-mastery. And I think that's a,
Okay, cool. Specifically the idea of the collaboration though with the others. Like I like the self-sovereignty as a goal that I think most people would want. But the specific idea of overcoming your dislike of somebody, that's where I sometimes feel that compassion pushers should be more honest about the first order feelings. And then only once they've sufficiently accepted why there might be good reasons to not have compassion, then you can work on your compassion. But without this sort of goal in mind, I feel that they end up making the feeling the goal. And then I'm like, why should I accept that as the goal? Where did that come from? There's a certain moralism that's like stuck into it, and it's never open for debate. So that's all I'm challenging or pointing out.
And it absolutely is bled into most acting institutions, by the way, at least that I've been a part of.
Yeah, I don't accept the worldview as true. I don't think it's false, but we should be able to have a conversation about why that's the worldview instead of just all nodding our heads. Yeah, we should be more empathetic.
Yep.
I don't know. I think we should be more discerning.
Totally.
And more transparent to ourselves about what our objectives are. And if we decide that we want to be more connected and feel more love, then we should do the things that enable it. But if we decide that we want to self-protect or do any number of other things, then we should do that. And it's totally have some empathy for yourself and knowing what your limits are. Of course, empathy is a trigger. So anyways, a man who likes nobody is, but so I had a thought on this. I know we said it was superficial, but for me, it is actually coming alive through this conversation. And it has actually aroused a sense of compassion in me for the person who likes nobody. There's a certain bait and switch happening in this quote. I don't know if you guys followed it, that almost is suggesting that a person who likes nobody is a person who might be well-liked. In other words, it's why isn't it possible to be both a person who likes nobody and also is liked by nobody? But he suggests that there's a contrast. As if you like nobody, you probably are liked by others. And if nobody likes you, then you probably like other people. So there's an asymmetry. He didn't say the worst, but the worst of all is to be liked by nobody and universally, and to like nobody. So that got me thinking that the person who likes nobody, okay, I'm reading into this quote, I'm constructing a character, is quite well liked. And that this person is in fact quite charming. And I think that this is very sad to be somebody who is so well-liked and at the same time, somebody who likes nobody. I think that that asymmetry is particularly sad. And there's different ways to think about the cause of this asymmetry. But one is that the person who likes nobody while being well-liked is, I think when you were talking about Hannibal, it made me think about this, is a narcissist. And see, everybody likes the charm of the narcissist. They put on a good party and whatever. But in a way, nobody actually sees them for who they are, which is like this empty shell of a person who's hiding behind all these accoutrements. And this is actually arousing our compassion for that empty void in them, as opposed to allowing us to be caught up in the charm. So it's very hard. I think probably the most hard to connect with is a person who doesn't allow themselves to be connected to. But somehow thinking about why that person is the way they are, so in a weird way, can make you compassionate and feel connected to them. So I don't know, just a thought. I'm not going to say King David from the Psalms and from the Bible is a narcissist. Don't quote me on that. God forbid I would say such a thing. But I will point out something quite fascinating about his character. This is the guy who plays the harp or the lion. He's universally beloved. Almost every single character in his story is said to love him. King Saul loves him. King Saul's daughters love him. King Saul's son loves him. This guy, wherever he walks, everybody around him cheers for him and celebrates him. It never once says that he loves anybody. So perhaps, and his name, by the way, David in Hebrew means, I believe it's related to the word beloved. This guy's name means beloved, and yet there is something deeply tragic about this beloved person whose experience of love is entirely asymmetric for as long as we can see him. Maybe you'll say, oh, he loves God, so he doesn't love other people, if you want to present it in a more pious way. But maybe it's just particularly burdensome for people who are so beloved to know what love is, because it comes with all of this pressure that you're fulfilling a role for other people. And then it's hard to know, what do you love? What do you desire when other people are putting so much desire and so much projection upon you?
What was the reason that he, correct me if I'm wrong, he didn't build the temple, but had to be his son after him?
He didn't build the temple according to tradition because he had too much blood on his hands. So he dug the foundations for the temple. But he didn't build the temple himself because he was a warrior, and the temple is associated with peace and the values of peace. So David is an unhappy figure, is the bottom line here. And so maybe that redeems the superficial reading. Also, if you think about
public and
celebrities, these are people who are probably so well-liked that it's hard for them to turn. Like, how can Taylor Swift have an authentic relationship with her fans, even if she's perceived to be super authentic? Then she just has to role play being an authentic superstar or whatever. It's got to be very intense.
Yeah, that was my thought too, was when you said that so hard, like billionaires, like everybody likes them because they can get something, right? Like they can bask in that glow. But then it's, who do billionaires like if they perceive everyone as only wanting to be around them for gain, like their own personal gain?
Exactly. Yeah. So you should have more compassion for the celebrities and the billionaires is really what it comes down to.
Francis, if he ever listens to us, he'll be like, yes, that's exactly right. We're gonna close it out, guys. This is fantastic. I do want to point out, I wanted to shout out Nico Sarion, who's our curator for the meditations. He finds the art and the music to pair it with the quotes. And he chose a portrait of Pope Innocent X for this one. And he's sitting in his chair looking very miserly. But it's interesting to what you said, Zohar, about maybe the man who likes nobody is someone who everybody likes, is like the Pope. In his time, everyone looks to the Pope as the vicar of God, and everyone loves the Pope, so to speak. Many people love the Pope. But like, he could very much be like an absolute misanthrope and super judgmental of his flock, and you wouldn't know it. But I thought, it was just shout out to Nico for that very great pairing. And it's amazing that you thought of that independently. Anyways, guys, you're missing out if you're not following Meditations, if you're not in the group chat on WhatsApp. The link's in the bio. We have a whole chat to discuss this stuff, just like we're doing here on the podcast, on Chronicles, on WhatsApp. Check it out. You can share this if you enjoyed it. We will see you next week.